Starting in 2017, I spent a year filming endangered red wolf puppies as they grew up in the Tallahassee Museum. I typically prefer to record animals in a natural setting, but here is an animal that had long since been declared extinct in the wild. As you might expect, the puppies and their shy parents were the stars of my documentary. The secret stars of my show, however, were the animal staff at the museum. Red wolves raised in captivity might be released into the wild, and I was routinely surprised at how the staff continuously engaged the wolves' animal senses. The more I visited, the more I learned about the practice of zoo science and all that it takes to care for animals as diverse as Florida panthers, bald eagles, and American alligators. Zoo science at the Tallahassee Museum is our topic today. This is Costa Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. I'm Rob Diaz de Villegas. Joining us in the studio today, we have Susie Buzzo, the animal curator at the Tallahassee Museum.
Hi, Rob. I'm excited to be here today.
Excited to have you. And we have Shelby Bush, the animal operations supervisor at the museum. How's it going, Shelby?
Great. Thank you so much for having us.
And for those of you watching on our video version of the podcast, we all have three guests crawling around the table. Who are these three guests that are crawling all over the table as we talk here?
We have three box turtles. Frank, Dragonfly, and Princess Buttercup, if you hear her scraping and banging on the table.
I'm looking at them. They're different sizes. They're different patterning on the shells here. So are we like in different ages, different species?
You know, a lot of the animals we get at the museum come from different places. Every once in a while, some of these turtles, they'll come from someone who had them as a pet and couldn't keep them anymore. The female over there was actually attacked by a dog and has some shell damage that had to be repaired. But there are four different species of box turtle, but the ones that we would have around us in Florida are the Gulf Coast, and these are the subspecies of the common box turtle. So it could be the Gulf Coast, the Florida, or the Eastern box turtle. And sometimes there could even be hybrids of the two. So we know we have Eastern box turtles and Florida box, but we're not quite sure about the little guy. He's probably an Eastern box turtle as well.
And he's little, but you were saying, how old is he? Maybe?
He is supposedly around 25 years old. So somebody found him as a baby and kept him. He looks in pretty good condition for most of the ones that we get that are captive kept, but there are some things that are a little bit off with them, a little bit overgrown beak, the nails are a little overgrown. He's very, very tiny, but otherwise, for those of you who can't see, he fits in the palm of my hand, no fingers. So somebody might think that he's a baby as well, so just leave him be if you find him, unless they're injured, and then get him to a rehab, which is what happened with Buttercup. You can see some teeth marks on the front of her shell, and she actually had to have a little bit of a repair under here where things had been chewed up and ripped off.
So quite a lot of the animals at the museum are animals that, I know there's a duck that was shot hunting, and then there's a lot of other animals that are otherwise injured, maybe. Talk about that, just that maybe can't survive in the wild, and so I like it to be an educational animal for animals of Florida. Yeah.
So most of the animals were either injured as baby or orphaned as babies or injured. They went to wildlife rehabilitators, and then they deemed them non-releasable. So we don't do the rehab ourselves, but if a wildlife rehabilitator calls us and says, we tried and this animal cannot be released, whether it's a eagle and it can't fly well enough to catch prey, or, just whatever reason, blind in one eye or whatever the injury is. So that's when we take them and give them a forever home in a natural setting.
So let's talk about the setting. So first, I was doing some Googling yesterday. At first I was titling this, zoology. But then I started looking at it. And so zoology is this overall study of animals in general. But, we're talking about a zoo science, correct? And so talk about that difference and sort of what goes into it. It's a lot more. Once I started working with you guys, it's a lot more than I ever would have thought it was.
Yeah, we do all the care and the husbandry. We do a lot of the medical stuff that we need to do with these animals. So it's not just we come in and we clean up poop and feed. There's so much more that goes into it. We try to give them a good quality of life by enriching their environment. We do training that improves their well-being and their welfare, depending on the species. So, like, for instance, We do training with our river otters. So we try to get them to a place where we can do voluntary injections. So we have a tube in the back. We do target training. They're very responsive. They react to it. And it gives them stimulus. It gives them something exciting to do with their day, you know. So there's all sorts of training and enrichment things that we do to just try to improve their quality of life.
Gotcha, gotcha. And then I guess part of it, too, is also just the setting they're in. So let's describe for people, you know, as you walk into the animal exhibit, you're walking on these boardwalks and you're in basically in a forested setting. Describe some of these enclosures and sort of the setting of where these animals live.
So we display mainly native animals in naturalistic habitats, literally have just tried to put fences around nature. Some can have trees to climb in. These guys like to dig and bury themselves when it gets cold.
But yeah, we use the natural settings of the lake. The deer can swim through parts of Lake Bradford. Mm-hmm. Some of the other animals have, you know, the lake enclosure as well. The bears can swim in their lake or their pool that was man-made with a waterfall and really, you know, fun and pretty, but it gives them options.
When we have to build a new exhibit, our aviaries were destroyed by a hurricane several years ago, so we had a blank slate to work with, but we try and put in as much of the natural props or exhibit furniture, as some folks will call it, to make it appropriate for their disabilities or injuries, but still to exhibit as many of their natural behaviors as possible, plants, water, climbing.
Yeah, whatever they need. We try to make sure we, you know, because it's not the same for every animal. It's not the same what you need for the birds of prey as it is for the foxes or the bobcats. So.
Right. And it changes too, because the lake gets fuller and less full. And there's times where I've gone and it looks really dry. And then there's times where you were talking about the deer. So I've gotten photos of that. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. There's so much water here. And those deer are wading through it. And then also, too, I've gone to the res and rented a canoe. And we've gone past the enclosures. And when the water is pretty full, you can get right up to the fence where the bears and the cougars are also up to the water there, too.
Yeah. And yeah, the cougars love the water. Right now it's very dry. So, yeah. We call that one cougar Rory our swamp kitty. She loves it.
So you care for a lot of animals of different sizes. We see the box turtles here. You also have, panthers and red wolves. I remember one time my family and I were at Swamp Stomp, which is for people at home. It's a concert that's held at the museum every summer. And we saw Shelby, and Shelby, you were showing us bald eagles, and you were also showing us that one of the bald eagles had given you a scar. Is that so talk about like the training you get to deal with these kind of large animals.
Well, we take every precaution that we can, but, you know, things can still happen. Like one of the things I brought here today were some things that we use with the red wolves or other animals. Like I have some big handling gloves. So these would be the type of gloves we would use with the bald eagles if we had to catch them for a procedure or to get weights or anything. So luckily they're really long. And, you know, we would go in with a sheet or a net and these gloves if we have to catch them. When we do the red wolves, we have all sorts of nets and poles and things. And this is actually one of the muzzles that we use with the red wolves. Okay. So the red wolves kind of go almost catatonic. They get sleepy or like just not sleepy, but they get relaxed when you actually catch them. So we like this muzzle because it actually covers their eyes so they don't have to look at what we're doing. But these type of things make it so we don't have to anesthetize the wolves every time we need to do handling or vaccines or whatever their yearly exams and stuff are.
I think the scar might have actually been from our old vulture Bucket.
Oh, okay. Okay.
who was a staff and visitor favorite. He was a black vulture. Unfortunately, he has passed away, but he had been an education animal but kind of become more mature. And I used to call it the yin and yang of their behavior. So it just kind of goes with he just turned on a dime one day and I did something wrong. I don't know what I did, but he decided to bite, and That's why these are wild animals. So as many people think, like, oh, he's so funny, he's so friendly, I really want him, he'd be a great... They are not pets. So we do know that, like she said, we normally take all the precautions. He normally didn't need that with him. He was a very good... He'd been an education animal. And but hormones kick in, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to... Let's talk about these turtles a little bit. So you have multiple different types of reptiles, and we'll work our way up to some of the larger animals. But what kind of we used to seeing like the red wolf and all these, you know, these really large enclosures. Where do you have all your different turtles in the? Because I've seen there's a few different spots where you have turtles and tortoises.
Yes.
At the museum.
Yeah, we've got turtles in a lot of places because a lot of people, you know. If turtles live a very long time, box turtles, they were up to 70 years, I think. And so people can have one box turtle as a pet, but not that many people want to keep a box turtle for 70 years. So yeah. Unfortunately, we get a lot of calls with, I can't keep this turtle anymore. I can't keep this turtle. And, you know, we surely cannot take them all, but we've taken some from people. And so one other problem we have with box turtles is they don't all get along. So yeah. We brought these thinking that they would get along well. The two of them actually live together, but the two... bigger ones actually live in our small bird of prey aviary with the duck and our screech owls because there's a pool in there. There's also an injured slider turtle that's in the pond. So that's kind of like a mixed species exhibit that we have with different things. The little guy, Frank, lives in our Discovery Center with another box turtle that was kept as a pet. She definitely couldn't live outside. She needs the proper, I mean, they do need proper lighting and everything, but her poor carapace, her shell is so messed up, and her beak is coming, you know, just yeah. really poor husbandry. So, you know, sometimes we'll take those because we're hoping to slightly correct it. We may never get her looking good, but her shell is all bumpy, and it's just... So he's looks pretty good for one that was kept, you know, as a house pet for a long time. But so many that we get are, and sometimes they don't even make it when, you know, somebody's done poor husbandry. So.
Explain that husbandry. So I have a picture in my mind what I think it means. But so what's poor husbandry?
Well, I mean, husbandry in general is just, you know, all the care that it takes for an animal. Right. So everything that's needed, like for them, it's the proper food, the proper supplements, the lighting, the care, the, you know, how many times you feed them, the temperature, everything involved in that. So
for the reptiles, the temperature, the lighting, the humidity are all incredibly important. The other thing with the box turtles is, since we'd said he fits in the palm of my hand, there's a whole lot of animals that could make this a very nice little meal, but a box turtle has a hinged plastron. That's their belly area, so that they can actually close up and protect themselves. So that is one of their defenses. But when they grow improperly because they haven't been cared for quite right or kept in, you know, indoor lighting rather than proper UV lighting, they can't close to protect themselves. With her, she was bitten by the dog and it actually exposed some area where she could no longer protect her head. Thankfully, one of our vets did a little bit of a repair, a prosthetic repair that makes it a little bit better for her to close up. However, their natural range is very specific to them. It's a very small area. We don't know exactly where she had come from. Right. So that's why she stays with us.
We wouldn't want to just release her once she had a repair to somewhere where we don't know where she actually came from. So,
gotcha. So one of my favorite animals that I see there, and it's hard to see a lot of times, but it's another turtle. It's an alligator snapping turtle. So talk about that little enclosure there. It's kind of hard to miss almost, but you walk on a boardwalk, if you right off the stage area, right? And then
he's actually moved from there. He got too big.
Oh, wow.
So the alligator snapping turtle actually lives with our alligators now.
Oh, wow.
So he's how many pounds now? I don't know. Close to 60, maybe?
Around there.
Yeah, and he's because the other sliders in there were not that big, so he's just too big for that area. So we moved him. But now you can see him a lot better. He's just a big guy in there with our four alligator girls.
Let's talk about that. So that's a relatively new exhibit. So you had to design a new exhibit for an animal that needs a lot more water than the other animals. So talk about that whole process. I mean, that was a big, you know, discussion and a lot of planning to do something like that.
Yeah, for sure. Our old alligator exhibit, you know, used to just have the lake water. And when the lake would come and go, it just wasn't good enough. So they didn't have the proper water that they needed. So when thinking about this, we contacted like zoo architects and zoo designers, and we went and did lots of visits to other alligator places like St. Augustine Alligator Farm. They were really helpful. So we were very lucky to get a grant to help us do that from COCA. And there was tons of keeper involvement in what we wanted and how we wanted it to look, even the plants. So we have pumps and filters and all that stuff that's needed to keep their water quality good. And then we got our four young alligators. Well, not too young, but our four alligator girls. So
there's four main components that will go into designing a new exhibit. What is good for the animals? What is good for the keepers? What is good for the public, and then the money. So you have that on a scale, and you need to be able to factor all of those things in. So sometimes it might be like, oh, well, why can you see that? Well, that's maybe our safety gate, or we try and hide some of those things as much as possible. Natural exhibit, natural plantings, things like that. It's good for the alligators, hopefully. You know, sometimes you have to look for the animals. They, especially for us, we are in natural habitat. So sometimes foxes like to get up in the trees.
Oh, yeah.
The bobcats like to get up in the trees.
There are always people looking for them. Yeah, there's always a,
yeah.
Did you see it? Yeah.
So that's some of the fun for the public to look for them and to find them and engage in that sort of thing. But so, yeah, there's that scale that we always need to work on.
I actually did bring an alligator. Do you want me to pull it out?
Yes, let's take a look.
While we're talking about alligators.
Yeah.
The tour of the studio.
Oh, wow.
So
we were discussing earlier about how old we think this alligator might be.
I believe he's just over two. So he came from, this one actually came from Gatorland. They do a little program with us where they will switch them out as they get too big. So he'll go back and move back there probably this year or next. But he lives in our Discovery Center with another one about his size. And he'll never, it's not like he's going to stay with us his whole life and eventually go into the alligator habitat because we don't have the good in-between place. So when he gets too big for the Discovery Center, he'll move on out.
Gotcha. And so how big are the alligators in the exhibit?
You measured them.
So they've grown quite a bit. We need to get another length and weight on them coming up, but they were all around 5.5 to 6 foot when we got them, and now they are all at least 6 to 6.5 foot. So they have grown. They've also gained a good bit of weight. Hmm. They've filled out, shall
we
say.
Yes.
But we do training with them and eventually hoping to be able to get them onto a scale so that we can weigh them regularly. So hopefully this winter, when they're a little calmer, we'll be able to get some of our stuff done so that in our programs, we might be able to measure somebody, weigh somebody for you.
Yeah, during the summer, we do alligator feedings. Right now, it's cool enough that they're not eating regularly, so we don't do that. But in the summer, we do them on Sundays at 2:30. Okay.
So you say they filled out. So where were they before?
They came from St. Augustine Alligator Farm.
Okay, okay.
And they gave us ones that had actually already lived together. And they said it was better to do a same-sex group than mixing the sexes. So we did that. And since they've already all lived together, we were hoping that they wouldn't fight when they got here or, you know. So they've actually done really well together.
One of our adult females was found in the Elkins River in West Virginia, which is not in their territory, not in their home range. So we don't really know how old she is. She was found around this size, around 2 foot or so, and was actually an education animal at another zoo up in West Virginia until she became too big and was sent to where we got our girl from. So now she's back at another facility. So,
but yeah, somebody probably had her when they shouldn't have and just released her out into a territory where she shouldn't have been. But that's another thing, maybe why Frank, the little box turtle, is so small, you know, just how he was kept.
So I want to get into enrichment. So I wonder, I mean, I guess, is it a lot different for the reptiles than it is for the mammals? I imagine the mammals maybe need more, but that's just me, you know, my human perspective on things. Do mammals need more enrichment than reptiles?
I feel like we do more enrichment for the mammals than the reptiles. For the reptiles, we try to switch things out in their enclosure or maybe add, you know, they got sensitive smells. So, you know, you could even add a tiny drop of a smell of something. But we can change substrates. We can change, you know, little sticks or props or plants for the reptiles.
Right. So substrates are just what's on
the bottom
of the... Yeah,
whether it's sand or mulch or, you know, it could be leaves or whatever else we want to add. Yeah. But yeah, doing those type of things just to their environment is probably what we do most with them.
So this is incredible enrichment for these guys today. We have... two who live together, but one, the little one that they've never met before, and he's never met them. He does live with another little one. It's a new environment. Enrichment is anything that will help bring out a natural behavior. So
does it affect a sense?
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a whole, I know we showed you one of the years when you came out filming, but we have like a whole cabinet full of different spices and smells.
Coyote urine. And different types of urine, red fox, raccoon, that definitely gets a pretty high reaction out of them. All the urines here. Woo!
Shelby's pulling some stuff out. She pulled out some curry powder. Curry powder is one that the panthers always love and different perfumes. She's got some obsession.
is a very popular one for for large cats especially. We had one of our former bears loved the stinkiest, nasty, cheapest men's musk you could ever find.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be the expensive stuff.
No. So we also have, it can be predator-prey, not interactions. You never want to scare anyone, but helping to elicit the prey caution and alertness or the predator stalking, you know, feathers can work as that type of thing.
What kind of feathers are we holding right
these
there?
These are turkey feathers.
Turkey feathers, okay. So a prey animal.
Yeah, and they're molting right now, so we can collect feathers nice. So if you see them looking funny,
we always use urine a lot. Our panther loves, our cougar, Remy and Rory, they both love the smell of fox urine. That's one of the favorites. Our otters, believe it or not, even though a cougar is more of a predator to them, our female otter loves the smell of panther pee.
Wow.
So we do our otter encounters on Saturday, and a lot of times we'll use urine from the panther, and we'll put it on different toys, and that's her first thing. She is intent on it, sniffing it so deeply.
Yeah.
So
that can be from moving bedding, substrate, hay, you know, hay or leaves from an area. Or it could be hunting spray, you know, the canned urines.
Spray urines.
Right, they're to attract the deer.
They're not quite as good, you know.
They're not as good as the real
thing. The real fox pee is...
ours has no preservatives.
It's got a wonderful scent. We used to have one of the foxes who didn't like his fruit, so he would make different scents every day. He would pee in his food bowl once he was done. So, you know, today was an eau de raspberry with it that he did not eat.
Another thing that you know that we do is, you know, like during the summer, we love making popsicles for the animals. So we make, you know, blood popsicles or fish juice popsicles. We even freeze crickets and mealworms into things. But, you know, it's not blood from an animal, but it's blood that comes out of the meat that we feed the carnivores. So,
but we
do a lot of that.
Enrichment can also be toys. These are actually from a wonderful recycling project. These are buoys that have washed ashore in northern Japan.
Oh, wow.
A former zookeeper and her partner were located at the Air Force or at the Army base there, and they would actually pick these up off of the beach, clean them, and zoos could we could pay for shipping to get them. So
we basically paid for the shipping, and she shipped. We have huge ones too, and the panthers really like them. There's one in the bear holding area right now in her bed for her to hold on to while she sleeps. But the panthers like them because they can stick their teeth in and carry them around, and
we can hang them. These ones actually have holes through them.
We froze fish inside there for the otters.
Mm-hmm. And so talk about some of these food things you make. So you're engaging all the senses, and that keeps them sort of, in their animalistic selves, right? Talk about these little puzzles you put together. I remember you wrapped some meat in a banana leaves one time, and then the red wolves were pulling them apart.
Yeah, so with the red wolves, it's tricky because they are critically endangered, and, they're totally different from some of the other animals that we have here in that they are owned by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we are, we're bound by all the rules for the program. And so we are not allowed to do these types of toys or anything, since they have the possibility of being released or their offspring do. We don't want them getting used to things like tennis balls or, toys that they will encounter if they stray too far and go into somebody's backyard. So we have to keep their enrichment a lot more natural. So I think what you're talking about is we make something we call palm frond burritos. So one of our volunteers, Mara, started that years ago, and we basically cut the palm frond and we'll wrap it up. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Palm frond tamales is what they are, not burritos. So we wrap them.
Tamales do come wrapped in banana leaves often. Yes.
So we wrap, the meat or whatever, thing we want to do. So that way we're not, because we're, another thing that a lot of our animals really love is cardboard. So we cats in boxes, the bobcats, the panthers, they want to sit in boxes. They love shredding it, but that's another thing we can't do for the red wolves. So we have to be really creative. We had somebody doing a capstone project with us not too long ago with the red wolves, and we hung deer legs from a tree, and we did different things, a lot more like whole prey items for them. So that's another type, just varying their types of meals is also another form of enrichment.
Remember with the red wolves, it was one day, I guess you had horse knuckles. Mm-hmm. And you put them, I remember that they were fighting over them. That was the day they started howling too. Some sirens were off. And that was a great day for video. I was like, wow, this is amazing. Aww. It was probably my favorite day out there. Just they did so many cool things.
Once a week, everybody gets bones. So we've got rib bone or all the carnivores and the omnivores. So rib bones, knuckle bones. And that's a favorite day. They help, also keep their teeth clean. The mechanical action of chewing on the bones. It's not just because they love it. It serves a purpose.
Right. And so we're at a time of year, it's the holiday season, right? So I know I remember giving you guys pumpkins to put out in the Red Wolf enclosure one time. I often see Christmas trees. So after Christmas, people maybe have Christmas trees and they want, you can use them all. Almost every enclosure, it seems, has a Christmas tree.
We usually don't take them from people because we get, all the Christmas tree farms. So once once Christmas Day ends, they're done with them. So they are happy for people to come pick them up. We just don't want to take the risk of any hidden hooks or anything happening or any like garland or tinsel or anything. But the animals, some will chew on them. Some will just, hide in them or pee on them, anything like that.
These are things, though, too, if you do make sure that they are completely removed. If you've got a semi-wooded backyard, set it back. It's a great, not necessarily enrichment, but it enhances your yard for wild birds or pumpkins. Find some woods because it's a natural dewormer. So they really do have their purposes, and you don't always have to throw something away. Things can get recycled, reused, give it a second life sometimes. So.
Very cool. Even Shelby's even just got, the simplest thing over there, a paper towel tube. So, we can fold the edges of that and stick little cat treats or dog treats, give it to the foxes. And as I talked about, differing types of food, Shelby's got some things there.
Yeah. As far as some of the things we do is making sure we have the proper diet, a regular diet, make sure it's healthy. So that can be as simple as a grocery store type food, which our dog food is dog kibble is the base diet for several of our animals. Some have very specialized diets. This is a croc biscuit for the alligators. Oddly, it becomes enrichment for our black bears. They actually really like them as well. I have no idea why. We have very specialized pellets. These are for our beaver, And there is just the wild herbivore.
Yep, it's high fiber, wild herbivore diet made by a company called Missouri that makes a lot of specialty products.
So this is one that we have to specially order. The crock biscuits are also from Missouri. They're the same thing that if you do go to any of the large alligator parks, sometimes you can buy to throw in. So that's what we're using here. It can be something natural that they would find normally that we just kind of collect extra. So we've got acorns that the beaver also really likes. The goats love them. Mm-hmm. So some of our farm animals, the pigs. It can be peanuts. We have so many animals that love peanuts right. or peanut butter.
And just like something people probably don't think of that, you know, another part of zookeeping and, you know, taking care of animals might be going around and foraging for acorns because maybe the enclosure for the animals that really like them just doesn't have it. So, you know, the beaver, our deer, some of the farm animals, they really need a lot of browse. So browse, you know, they need different plants, you know, the types of things that they would be eating in the wild. So sometimes the, you know, the zoo diets can't replicate everything that they need. So we go, you know, we'll be off cutting mulberry or smilax. You know, we found the female black bear really loves the Bidens.
Oh, like, really? Wow.
Yeah, those ones that drive you crazy. Get all yeah. those stickers on you.
We always need to make sure that everything is safe. So that becomes the more technical part of things is making sure, you know, as a zookeeper, we still need to know some botany, you know. We
right.
need
yeah.
to know which plants are safe. One thing, red maple. Great tree. Love it down here. It's a beautiful, native, natural tree that we want to see. Leaves are fine when they're green. When they die, they can kill a horse.
Oh, wow.
So there's a lot of things that go into that. You can't just pick something up and give it to them. So we're always real careful with adding a new, you know, adding something new.
And we check with our veterinarian on a lot of things. We also look at lots of toxicity lists and, you know, consult with other zoos if we ever have questions about that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So. It seems like there's a lot of resources available to you anyway. I know when I've talked to you in the past, especially with the red wolves, since that's just a network of zoos that are raising red wolves. I want to talk about the red wolves now. So they're, like you were saying, they're different than every other animal you have there. They're where a lot of your animals are injured. They're not. They are heavily protected and are bred in a specific way. So let's walk it back to late 1970s, early 1980s. How mm-hmm. many red wolves are there, and how did this whole species protection plan?
Yeah, well, they used to roam the whole southeast, and you know they were all over Florida. They were all the way up, you know, a lot of the East Coast, too, and out to Texas. So now in the 70s, they realized there weren't hardly any left because of coyotes moving east, as well as just lots of hunting and development.
Right.
And, you know, you could get $5 if you killed a breeding female, and people would just bounties out on them, and it was bad. So when they realized that, they took the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, took the remaining 14 wolves that they caught out of the wild and started the breeding program. They took a bunch of animals, but they found that there were coyote hybrids and different things. So with that, those 14 animals, they started a very serious program, and it took a while before they could release, but they were eventually able to start releasing them into eastern North Carolina. So the whole Alligator River area, and it's private and public lands, and the program was doing really well and for a while. So that's the program that we're part of. They did hit a lot of roadblocks out there when they were releasing them, and they weren't able to release for some time. But now we're all back on the right track, and things are going very well.
Good.
There's 300. So it used to be just called the Species Survival Plan.
Right.
They changed it a couple years back because they said species survival plans couldn't be externally managed. And since this one is externally managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, that's when they made that change. So it is now called the SAFE program. So it's like AZA's Saving Animals from Extinction. And so we are part of that breeding program. So we don't get to decide, you know, what happens with the wolves. Everything is decided through the program and through the management team of that program. So every July they get together, and because these guys, even though they're canids, they only breed once a year. So they usually breed anywhere from late January to March and then have their puppies in April to May. And so they decide in July what's going to happen for the next year. So they put together this list, the mean kinship list, that tells how related all the individuals are. And there are currently 300 in managed care, you know, the ones we have, the ones other zoos and wildlife centers have. And then in the wild, there are less than 30. I think there's only like 18 collared, but they believe there's less than 30, you know, out there. So they're working very hard to make that spot safe for them.
Yeah. Gotcha. And then so every July they decide, right? Mm-hmm. And so in 2017, you got a litter of puppies born. That's when I went out there and we shot video, right? And then the sort of the alpha puppy of that group became your breeding male later on, and a female came in, and he had how many puppies last year?
They only had two.
Right.
They had two. So it was her first litter. And it, you know, they were very good parents. Looks like Frank is thinking about trying some dog food over there.
Okay, that's some enrichment.
but then they were able to stay with mom and dad the following year.
Right.
And then this year, in July, they said, okay, well, we don't want mom and dad, you know, our two to breed again. So they had to split them up, because it also became the time that the young were old enough to breed. So they didn't want the young to be able to breed with their parents or anything like that. So they decided at the Tallahassee Museum, we were going to keep the mother Arrow and her daughter Artemis. And then dad Rainier, that was born with us, you know, in 2017, he just moved with his son Apollo. So, you know, they went up north.
Wow. So talk about that. You know, I'm really happy you guys are able to be here today. You've had a week, though, huh?
Yeah, it was a busy week. Sometimes there's all, you know, sometimes it's animal transport that we have to do. So, you know, part of being in that program is, you know, when they say, okay, these two wolves are going to actually move all the way up to Minnesota, you got to get them there. So, and with issues with flights, we didn't want to risk that. So mm-hmm. we wanted to make sure the wolves were, they got to where they needed to be and everything was good and safe. So Shelby and I just drove them halfway to Minnesota. So luckily the people there drove halfway. They drove halfway, we drove halfway, and we met in Louisville, Kentucky to transfer the wolves over. And then we had to do another animal transport, or we had to go pick up animals that will be our next guest animal.
Gotcha. So what is the next guest animal?
Well, the exhibit is probably going to be opening on December 20th, so that weekend. And we are getting two binturongs. We just brought them in last night.
So describe a binturong. It doesn't sound like a name of an animal most people know.
Yeah. They're also called Asian bear cats, but they're not a bear or a cat. So these two are probably around 30, 35 pounds. They're black and shaggy. They're actually the largest mammal with a prehensile tail. So they can hold on to things with their tail. They're very good climbers, mostly arboreal. They're pretty cool looking. Some people say they smell like buttered popcorn, but I just think They smell like something. But hopefully they're going to be fun. They really enjoy eating bananas, so I think that's going to be their favorite treat with us. So we're finishing up their exhibit now and getting it all ready for them.
So our wolves went up to the Wildlife Nature Center in Stacy, Minnesota. So bit of a temperature change for our poor kids from Florida to now feeling like negative 15 today, but they know they're well cared for up there. It's another wonderful facility that's been part of the program, and Mexican gray wolves as well. Unfortunately, along the side of the road, we ended up seeing multiple deer that had been hit by cars. And this is where there's a problem without the keystone predator species. The prey species can overpopulate. Everybody's seen a deer on the side of the road.
Yeah, just this week I did.
Unfortunately, you know, early on it was the wolves are killing our farm animals, or they're killing our deer that are part of a hunting preserve or something like that, or just hunting in general. But people don't take into consideration that when we have those wild predators in the areas that they're supposed to be, They're generally taking out the elderly, the sick. So they're actually making it better for hunters or things like that. So that's why it's important to get them back into their native lands. But I mean, so it's still a long trip.
Yeah. And they're doing a lot of great work in Eastern North Carolina, trying to keep them, making corridors and putting up signs. And they actually changed the color of the radio collars that the Red Wolves wear mm-hmm. to make them more reflective so people will not hit them by cars.
Is it true they've sterilized all the coyotes in the vicinity around them so they can't
not
breed?
They haven't gotten all the coyotes, right. But they do sterilize coyotes. Yeah, that's an ongoing program.
And so there are coyotes that were found in Galveston maybe a few years ago that have, they said, some really interesting red wolf DNA still in them.
Yeah.
Is there any plan to, you know, they say the DNA itself is different, you know, and it might be important in some way to preserve that DNA, but like
it's
there's no way
to keep track of them. Right now, it wouldn't be the right idea to add them to this, you know, the SAFE program because we don't want to start adding hybrids. We want this to be pure. But I know they're, you know, they're keeping an eye on that, the whole Galveston project. So, you know, they know where they are. And so it could be something for the future. But even like part of that program, we just did the exams on all four of the wolves that we currently had before we brought the boys on our trip. But part of being part of that is we actually had to do blood banking. So we had to get specific little samples of blood when we took our regular blood to do lab work on the animals. And we have to send them off to Arkansas State University. They're the ones who are banking tissue samples, whole animals. So like if one of our red wolves passes away, we have to do a very detailed necropsy. You can actually ship the whole animal to them or samples of organs and stuff. So they hold on to that to keep the DNA. So it's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk. I want to stay on predators, then we can move on. Do you want to talk about the beaver for sure? Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Buddha, the Florida panther. So we met him. I met him a couple of years ago. We spent a nice day, and you spend a lot of time with these animals over time, and then obviously, you know, animal lifespans typically are shorter than human lifespans. Talk about sort of becoming attached and sort of when your animals move on.
It's the hardest part of the job for sure. You know, the fact that we do give them this forever home and they stay with us, you know, their whole lives, you really do get attached. And you get attached to some animals more than others. It just happens that way. Same with your own pets. And Buddha was extremely special. So I think he was special to every single one of us. You know, certain ones are like, oh, you know, I really love this one, but other people don't love him as much. But yeah, everybody who met Buddha loved Buddha. So he just had one of those personalities that, you know, he purred for everyone. So you got some good purring on video one time, I remember.
Yeah.
So that was tough. You know, we know in the end we did what was best for him. We didn't want him to have to suffer. So, but we all needed to take a week off after that one. That was very difficult for us.
Zookeeping is definitely a passion job.
We don't do it for the money.
You're never going to get rich. Your richness comes from your interaction with them. It's kind of one of the hardest working jobs. You'll still go home smiling. You may be stinky, disgusting, covered in who knows what, but for the most part, you go home happy, knowing that you've done what you can. The animals return the favor a lot of time for the hard work with their attitudes or even just watching our little turtles and their interactions with each other. But yeah, it'll also break your heart.
I bet. So part of that too is, I mean, I think I know people who are regular visitors of the Taos Museum and I think everyone forms their own attachments to the animals too. And they also, I guess I was doing a segment on red wolves. And I was just there with the two breeding adults, and you guys said that you think that the mom's pregnant, and that was something that people told you that saw them breeding. So talk about this sort of your relationship with the people who attend the museum, and sort of what you get from them, and vice versa. Sort of this, you know, they're part of the equation too, right?
Yeah. I mean, we love all of our visitors, and we do have lots of families, lots of people that are just regular, you know, people who come weekly, people that even come multiple times a week. So we are so thankful for all of them. But a funny thing about some of the animals is, like the wolves, for example, they know the keepers come, and, you know, we sometimes have to catch them up. We do tough things. You know, we have to give them their shots and everything. So a lot of times when they see us, they'll run to the other side and hide. So they're not as comfortable, you know, seeing us. So even though we put up cameras and try to watch for these types of behaviors, when they see visitors on the boardwalk, they're not, you know, worried about them. So, yeah, the visitors on the boardwalk, I think even two different years had told us, you know, okay, they're mating. We saw them in a tie. So
yeah.
We go up and get all the information from the visitor on the boardwalk and put it in their records.
Yeah, we're a very small staff. We have lots of wonderful volunteers, too. We just couldn't live without. But we also can't live without the visitors, too. They're what keep us going, the reason we're there. But we also can't be in two places at once. So we always appreciate, you know, whether it's a little kid telling us a fun fact that they've noticed, or telling us that they are mating, or finding, you know, even questioning. Sometimes they may see something, and we appreciate questions.
Yeah.
So we don't want you to, oh, it's sleeping all the time. It's bored. No, this is, come talk to us, and we can discuss, you know, their behaviors, what's actually going on. Is it an elderly animal? Is it a baby? Has it been sick? Did something happen yesterday? Was there a storm? Was there tree trimming?
Right.
That can affect things. So we do always appreciate observations and questions.
And the outpouring of love that happened after Buddha on social media was, like, amazing. We even had a family that comes out all the time. Oh my gosh, this one really got to us. But they went to Buddha's habitat and put sunflowers into the fencing around. And we thought it was another staff member, but it was actually visitors who cared that much. And they so we love our visitors.
Wow. That's touching.
Yeah.
I still have one of those sunflowers next to my desk. One dried, one left. So we still have that sunflower from the visitors.
I mean, that's the fun part of it, too, is, I mean, when you visit multiple times, like you were talking about, you know, why they're doing this time, you know, that they're always doing something a little different. And it just, you know, you don't get to see that. Even if you, like me, go out into nature a lot, you know, these animals a lot of times are pretty reclusive and you don't get to see. And I always wonder now, like, how many times am I walking under a bobcat sleeping on a branch above me in the forest, right?
Or a gray fox in a tree.
Yeah. And then just also the fact that you know, Florida panthers and red wolves used to be in the Florida Panhandle, and we don't see them anymore. And it's just kind of cool to think about that when you're out there.
Yeah.
Another animal most of us don't see, and maybe people, I never really thought of them being in Florida a lot, are beavers. So you have a beaver now. Talk about the beaver that you have.
Yeah, we have a new beaver. He's an ambassador animal, so he's not out on, you know, he doesn't have a large exhibit out on display, but his name is Barkley, and he actually came from South Georgia, but they are all around our area. Somebody, Department of Natural Resources guy, was taking a hike, and a baby, little tiny baby beaver came up to the back of his leg. And so the guy's like, "Where did you come from?" And he kept walking up and down the river, and it turns out they found a beaver dam exploded by dynamite. And so we got a call from a rehabber up there who'd known I'd always wanted to have a beaver. And so she sent us a picture of this adorable little tiny fluffy brown thing and said, "Do you want him?" And I said, "Yes, please." So
you should show the picture.
We learned very quickly how what we needed to do. I didn't even know at the time they made powdered beaver milk.
Okay.
So I had to order that right away. And we just got prepared. So he lives with us now, and he comes out. I wish we could have brought him to the studio, but he still needs a little more work. We have an area like for our ambassador animals to go, and we have a small pool out there. So we walk him out there, and we do programs with him. But otherwise, he has a pool and everything in his behind the scenes area. But beavers are really important to the landscape, and so we wanted to make sure we could talk about them.
And beavers generally stay with their family for about two and a half years. So even though he's probably close to full grown, he's still very much a toddler.
Yeah.
And so just trying to meet the growing up behaviors. And so, but he's very good at dam building and lodge building. But they're another one of those keystone species of that we need them to help with creating wetlands. They can adjust them to how we live as well, but they really need to be here. There's so much that.
Yeah, they call him nature's architect. You know, they do so much. I mean, they even help with climate change. They help with wildfires because the wetlands they create can help with wildfire breaks.
Right.
So they're very important. And the wetlands they make create, you know, habitat for so many other species.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the education aspect of what you do. And so you have to be really up on, you know, you have to care for these animals in captivity, but you have to know a lot about them in the wild and to talk to people because people – like you said, someone decided to blow up a dam with dynamite.
And then
obviously predators have always been hunted. People have this fear of them. So talk about this aspect of you know, learning about and educating the public about animals and sort of how we can maybe better coexist with them.
Yeah, I mean, for us especially, you know, we need to know about everything that happens in the wild, like all of their needs for the wild to be able to best care for them in captivity. But we do have a great education department. You know, we do all the care for all these guys, and they are the ones who do the presentations for the public. So, you know, we make sure we try to give, you know, all the information that we can to educate our visitors. You know, we go to schools, we do Girl Scout stuff, we go to all sorts of festivals, and, you know, we even have a preschool on the property. So we, you know, we're very big into educating, whether it's about all of the animals and nature and wildlife or the history of the Big Bend area. But, you know, that's one of the most important things we do is try to educate the public.
Yeah. And it was just summer camp, too. I know I had a friend whose daughter went to the summer camp, and remember she posted on Facebook one day, oh, my daughter made blood popsicles today.
Yeah, there's zoo camps, but there's so many other camps that we do, all different themes. So it's not only just about animals, but all sorts of themes. Lots of fun camps.
But yeah, there's the homeschooling groups, the Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, I think they can do badges,
do sleepovers.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So yeah. Well, a lot of that.
So I kind of want to go behind the scenes a little bit. I was thinking about it earlier, but you know, because you talk about designing an exhibit for the curators as well. But, you know, there's this whole behind the scenes area, and I get to go back there every once in a while and talk to you guys. So behind all of the exhibits, there's something you call the animal kitchen. So what do you all do in the animal kitchen?
I mean, it's called, like, you know, like in a bigger zoo, they would call it the commissary. We just call it the animal kitchen. It's basically just our home base, like our building that has everything. It includes, you know, our surgery room is there and our vet tech room. We've got a quarantine area where we can put new animals. And it's kind of the backside. Like if you go to the museum, you're going to walk on the boardwalks around, and we're kind of like the middle of it all. So our building like backs up to all the enclosures. So we have like access to all their holding areas.
It's our freezers. It's where we make the food, keep the products, our refrigerators, because we have the dry foods, which is the type of stuff we have here, but we also need lots of fresh food. We have, you talked about the knuckles. Those are purchased from a company that makes meats that are specially formulated that have all their vitamins and everything in it, the bones, the muscles. So that's something that we can't just go to the store and buy, you know, that. So if you are trying to have a pet of your own, you can't always just feed it.
Yeah,
you know, a piece of steak or whatever.
Right.
It's not getting all of their vitamins, because these animals in the wild would eat the bones, would eat some of the skin, would eat the tendons, the cartilage. So it's just, it has all of that involved as well in a much easier to use, kind of looks like a hamburger meat. So if you ever do see meats out there like that, It's not hamburger. It's specially prepared. We also have medications that some of our animals are on, or supplements that we'll add as they're getting older.
I mean, animals in captivity usually have a longer lifespan than animals in the wild because of that care. So you know, as soon as they turn 7 years old, we start giving, you know, joint supplements to a lot of the animals. You know, if they're, since they're outside and they're not indoors, they might have, you know, it might be worse on their coats. So we give fish oil and different supplements like to help their coats. And so we have a whole list, you know, all gotten together by our veterinarian, Dr. Manuel. And she just kind of oversees our whole veterinary program. And so that in that animal kitchen.
Vaccines mm-hmm. and yearly checkups.
So. Yeah. So between the animal care staff and the volunteers, you know, the day involves cleaning up all these enclosures, taking care of, you know, looking at all the animals, checking on their health and well-being, and then coming to our animal kitchen area and washing a million dishes and then starting to make the diets. We have a big screen that has all the diets on it and all the supplements and medications. And so we get through all that, and then it's time for feeding and every other thing we have to do.
Right. Is feeding a good time to see activity? Sometimes I'm there in the morning. I guess when I was shooting the Red Wolves, I remember, you know, I guess they, they put the pig knuckles or the horse knuckles out and things like that. And maybe that's when.
It depends. There's so many variables there because it depends on the time of year, the species, everything. You know, some of our animals actually come behind the scenes for some of their meals. I think one of the best times to come to see the most is when we first open. That's when some of the animals are being let out of night enclosures. You know, the animals are seeing us come in. They get excited. Food is coming. So that is one of the best times, I think. But depending on the species, depends on how many times a day we feed them. You know, some of these reptiles might only eat once a week. Some animals eat three times a day. So it all depends.
So as we kind of start to wrap up, I want to... So you guys have been working with a lot of different types of animals for a while now, and you've probably, what have you learned that most surprised you about any animal behavior, or anything that just from working directly with the animals, what thing really like was, wow, I had no idea that, you know, turkeys or deer or vultures or anyone did what they did.
Oh, gosh. you said turkeys. I never knew turkeys could fly, you know, 50 miles an hour? Like, shoot. There's so many things that we've learned. I've been at the museum for 25 years, so there's like a ton of stuff.
Well, we do have the guest animal exhibit, and so that one's always working with different species than we're normally working with. sometimes emus too. we were told we had two females and a male when we got those, and well, we kind of found out that it was two males and a female. Sometimes you find out things the hard way when...
Yeah, that story I was going to say about the emu was when we were sending them back to the zoo where they came from, we were trying to load them up into the trailer where they had to go. And we were just kind of walking behind them like, it's time to go. And they were walking along, but the one that I was behind changed its mind, ducked down and backed up right in between my legs, and then stood up, and I ended up riding an emu for a couple of seconds. It was not what I was expecting, but yeah, the guest animal is probably one of those things that, you know, we get to work with different species and we get to learn new things, you know, and that's where some surprises come in. So that's always fun.
It's a lot of fun to that one. We're not fully designing, but we get to kind of reimagine it. So that's part of it as well. We become carpenters and builders and horticulturists. And it's all species that we've had experience with, whether it's at other facilities or through rehab, different things. But because we all have to have, or there has to be somebody that has experience with those species or similar species at the facility. So
it's also really fun just trying to, you know, the enrichment aspect of it is when you find something that the animal really likes that you weren't expecting. Like sometimes you think, oh my gosh, you know, the otter always loves this type of thing. And then you give it to them and they don't care at all. And you're all disappointed. And then one time I threw in a whole walnut, like in the shell, into the otter pool. And she played with it for like an hour, swimming around with it on her forehead, having such a good time. Or like with the otter we found, you know, this was approved by our vet, but we decided to just throw some spaghetti noodles in, you know, like, oh, we'll see what she thinks about that. She loved those spaghetti noodles, had so much fun with them. So just like kind of finding unusual things that just really bring
novel
the animals joy.
Novel enrichment, novel, yeah. A novel toy, a novel food.
Yeah, know. Right now one of the female otter's favorite toys is this little wooden purple maraca, and she takes it all around with her and carries it. So that's good times. That makes it worth it.
I guess what I'm wondering is, so a lot of people, you know, working in zookeeping are working in zoos with a lot of different types of animals from all over the world. You're working with a lot of animals that live in our native habitats. Does that sort of enhance sort of your sort of outdoor experiences just here in North Florida?
I think so. I think it makes it our place really special because, you know, there's endangered animals all over the world. There's threatened animals. But, you know, everybody knows about giant pandas and everybody knows about elephants, but we really like to educate the people on the species that are in their own backyard because so many people have never seen, you know, a bobcat, and they're here, they're in our neighborhoods, they're around. And I really appreciate the fact that we get to focus on these species and care for these species that are the ones that live with us.
All right. Well, thank you guys so much. This was such a fun conversation, and it's a lot of fun. Try not to get distracted by box turtles crawling all around the table out here. So thank you, Shelby Bush, Susie Buzzo, for coming in today for Costa Canopy.
Thank you, Rob. It's been fun.
Yes. Thank you so much for having us. And please come out again. We always love when you come out.
Oh, yeah. Well, I will be this week. Yeah.
If you listen to the audio version of this podcast, you missed out on a lot of visuals. In the studio, we met three box turtles and a young alligator. We also saw a beaver, binturongs, red wolves, Buddha the Florida panther, and a few others. You can find the video version of Costa Canopy at wfsu.org/ecologyblog and on the WFSU Ecology YouTube channel. While you're on the blog, you can find a recent segment on alligators in the Okefenokee Swamp or see glow-in-the-dark scorpions. As you scroll down, you'll see that we were busy in 2025. In the last year, WFSU Ecology premiered two documentaries, kicked off this podcast, and continued to explore our natural area. In any other year, I'd say it was my best year working at WFSU. But this year, we, along with PBS and NPR stations around the country, lost federal funding. And, along with other Florida public broadcasters, we lost state funding as well. We felt that here. WFSU Ecology will continue, but we need your help. That's why we started the Seed Circle. Any amount helps, but for a $10 a month pledge, I'll give you a shout out on this podcast, like right now. Thank you to David Blair, Carol Goodyear, Veronica Humphrey, Lisa Johnson, Chris McFarland, Carrie Maddox, Clara Mullins, Alina Pryor, Dylan Riles Hamilton, Kim Sash, and Donna Tharp. You can join the Seed Circle at wfsu.org/ecologyblog. This has been Costa Canopy, an ecology podcast from WFSU Public Media. Today, we had Taylor Cox running audio, Jason Acuna on the RoboCams, and Ian McGordy directing. Lydell Rawls took some of the photos we used on the blog and on the video version. And I am your host and producer of all things ecology at WFSU, Rob Diaz de Villegas.